The first reading is from the book of Leviticus, chapter 20, verses 22 to 26, which can be found on page 120 in the Old Testament section of the Church Bibles. Leviticus, chapter 20, verses 22 to 26. The Lord said, "Keep all my laws and commands, so that you will not be rejected by the land of Canaan into which I am bringing you. Do not adopt the customs of people who live there. I am driving out those pagans so that you can enter the land. They have disgusted me with all their evil practices, but I have promised you this rich and fertile land as your possession, and I will give it to you. I am the Lord your God, and I have set you apart from the other nations. So then, you must make a clear distinction between animals and birds that are ritually clean and those that are not. Do not eat unclean animals or birds. I have declared them unclean, and eating them would make you unclean. You shall be holy and belong only to me, because I am the Lord, and I am holy. I have set you apart from the other nations, so that you would belong to me alone." Thanks be to God.
Act 10, verses 1 to 29 from the New Testament. Cornelius calls for Peter. At Caesarea, there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion in what was known as the Italian regiment. He and all his family were devout and God-fearing. He gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. One day, at about 3 p.m, he had a vision. He distinctly saw an angel of God, who came to him and said,
"Cornelius."
Cornelius stared at him in fear. "What is it, Lord?" he asked. The angel answered,
"Your prayers are a gift to the poor. How come? Up as a memorial offering before God. Now send them to Joppa to bring back a man named Simon who is called Peter. He is staying with Simon the tanner who is by the sea."
When the angel who spoke to him had gone, Cornelius called two of his servants and a devout soldier who was one of his attendants. He told them everything that had happened and sent them to Joppa. Peter's vision. About noon the following day, as they were on their journey and approaching the city, Peter went up on the roof to pray. He became hungry and wanted something to eat. And while the meal was being prepared, he fell into a trance. He saw heaven opened and something coming down that looked like a large sheet being lowered to earth by its four corners. It contained all kinds of four-footed animals, as well as reptiles and birds. Then a voice told him,
"Get up, Peter, kill and eat."
"Surely not, Lord," Peter replied. "I have never eaten anything impure or unclean." The voice spoke to him a second time.
"Do not call anything impure that God has made clean."
This happened three times, and immediately the sheet was taken back to heaven. While Peter was wondering about the meaning of the vision, the men sent by Cornelius found out where Simon's house was and stopped at the gate. They called out, asking if Simon, who was known as Peter, was staying there. While Peter was still thinking about the vision, the Spirit said to him,
Simon, three men are looking for you, so get up and go downstairs. Do not hesitate to go with them, for I have sent them.
Peter went down and said to the men, I'm the one you're looking for. Why have you come? The men replied, we have come from Cornelius the centurion. He is a righteous and God-fearing man who is respected by all the Jewish people. A holy angel told him to ask you to come to his house so that he could hear what you have to say. Then Peter invited the men into the house to be his guests. Peter at Cornelius's house. The next day Peter started out with them, and some of the believers from Joppa went along. The following day he arrived in Caesarea. Cornelius was expecting them and had called together his relatives and close friends. As Peter entered the house, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet in reverence. But Peter made him get up. Stand up, he said. I am only a man myself. While talking with him, Peter went inside and found a large gathering of people. He said to them, you are well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with or visit a Gentile. But God has shown me that I shall not call anyone impure or unclean. So when I was sent for, I came without raising any objection. May I ask why you sent for me?
When God led Israel out of slavery in Egypt, he brought them into the wilderness of Sinai and to Mount Horeb. And there at the mountain, they were called to be God's people, as he would be their God. It was a promise that God had given to their fathers before them, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so God called the whole nation of the Hebrews at that point and set them apart as a people. He separated them from the other nations, and he commanded them to only worship him, to have only him as their God, and consequently to have practices that were different from the nations that they would embark on their journeys. It was God who called them. It wasn't an idea that the Hebrews had themselves. It was God who came to them and said, I will be your God and you will be my people. You are my chosen people. You are a chosen nation. And it happens with God's doing, with God's acting. It was God's initiative. And they were set apart, they were separated from the others for God. The idea that Israel was going to be a nation other than other nations was to glorify God, to give him the honor, to praise him alone, and to make his name known among the other nations. Make his name known in Israel, but by what God would be doing for Israel and with Israel, his name would be known to the other nations around. And so their separation was meant to become a blessing to the other nations. Just as Abraham had been promised, I will make you and your seed a blessing for the nations. And to help them with that, Moses received God's law for Israel. And in God's law, there are certain rules, we know that. And Moses came with those laws from the mountain where he had received them from God. And those were rules and laws to help the people know how to live, what the best way was to live a life that would honor God and that would bless the people. Now, the narrative of Israel, we as Christians recognize and understand as part of our own story. It has become part of the Christian story. Because we ourselves know and understand that we too are called by God as people and are set apart in a way from the rest of the world. We do not follow many things that other people find perfectly normal to do. We separate ourselves from certain practices and we are trying to live our life for God, to give him honor, to glorify him in our lives, to make him known to others, and to, in our own life, in turn, be a blessing to the people around us. And part of that, we can still see today, even though we often hear that we are past the Christian age and Christendom is no longer here in England. We can still see around us the history of how Christian people try to be a blessing for the communities around them. And it was often through the churches that we have now education in England and in other countries. My own home country, the Netherlands, is an example of that. Hospitals were set up by churches. And the whole social welfare system that we know in this country, it has flown out of Christian practices. Now, to just go back for a moment to Israel, it did not take them very long to start questioning the whole idea of being God's covenantal people. We all like to be chosen, and we know that from when we were back in school. Some of us are still carrying the scars of not being chosen for the PE group or whatever. We like to know that we are special. We like to be chosen from among the other people around us. But we also like to be free from rules. And we would like to have a choice whether we want to be chosen or not in the first place. And the Israelites, and we too for that matter, were free to walk away from God. And we are free to make that choice, whether we are going to follow God and live our life for him, or whether we are going to walk away from it. And of course, for Israel, we hear and we read their story throughout the Bible of how that worked out for them as a nation, of people who kept walking away from God, and of God's faithfulness to them, and God coming back to them again and again to save them and to bring them back to himself. But every now and then, there would be a movement in Israel that would recognize this old covenant that God had made with his people. And there would be groups of people kindling that again and firing that up again within the nation. And so when Jesus was living his life on earth, one of those groups who tried to do that were the Pharisees. They were very, very passionate about observing God's law. They were very passionate about living life in the way that it was described in God's law. And they studied it. They studied the law. They looked at every little iota of it, and they observed it everywhere they could and in every possible way. And just, you know, the word Pharisee itself means separatist. So it just describes they separated themselves from people around them. And they observed ritual purity. They made sure that their food was kosher and was prepared in a certain way with certain utensils and in special ways. And they would not share table fellowship with people who would not practice those kind of rules. And of course, the consequence of that is that they would only socialize with a certain group of people and not with the people who would not observe their rules of cleanliness. They were a separate group and they had a lot to say about what Jesus was doing. The way he behaved on the Sabbath, the way he did not seem to worry about hanging out with people who did not follow those cleanliness rules. His idea of it's perfectly okay not to wash your hands before dinner or touching food. All those kind of things. But Jesus is very clear in his condemnation about them. Because what the Pharisees were doing in their understanding and studying of the law, they were getting so bogged down with the rules that was all they could focus on. And that was the only thing that kept their minds and hearts busy. And the problem with that is that in the process, they restricted God's grace. If you did not exactly do what they understood the law to say, you would be outside the covenant and God's grace would not count for you. And so they turned the nation and the religious scene of the day into something that was meager and emaciated rather than fat and healthy. They preached and they observed a way of life that had to do with scarcity. And had nothing to do with the abundance of God's love and God's grace. And in a way, they almost reversed God's blessing on the people. Jesus is not at all impressed with that. And he sets an example which is radically different from theirs. Instead of separating himself from the people, he gets involved. Instead of keeping table fellowship with the pure and the clean, he hangs out with sinners and prostitutes. He throws parties together with tax collectors. He touches lepers. And he even is happy to have a conversation and speak with Gentiles. He even heals them. You see, Jesus came to earth to fulfill God's law, to take every little aspect of it, every little iota, and fulfill it in himself. In a way, you know, there is this words explosion versus implosion. And I have implosion. Is that the right word? Implosion? Yes. And I have been told some time ago that something imploding, there is actually more force into that kind of thing going on as when you have an explosion. And in a way, the whole of God's law imploded into Jesus coming to earth, showing us God's amazing love, what it really meant to follow God's law, what the heart of God's law was, that it is about love, about grace, about forgiveness, about life. That is what he showed his disciples. And after the resurrection and the ascension of Jesus, the church followed his example. And it grew and it spread throughout Palestine and Samaria, Judea. And Peter, as we know, became one of the key figures in that. He had worked and lived with Jesus for 3 years, just like his friends, the other disciples. But for Peter, it was so counterintuitive to bring the gospel to the Gentiles that he needed a vision to be told that it was actually okay to go there. And I think, if we think back for a moment to our little exercise earlier, there are things in our life and in our society, in our world, that we would just not like to touch, that we really would rather keep ourselves away from. It is like that for Peter when the sheet full of animals comes out of heaven and the voice says, kill and eat. Peter says, there is no way on this earth that I will ever do that. 3 times it took him to say that before he realized, okay, perhaps this is something that is actually okay to do, you know. It was absolutely huge for Peter and his friends. But the thing is, in the end, Peter didn't believe that the voice he heard was from God. In the end, Peter is someone who is quite happy to take a risk. And it had always been like that anyway. He was radical in his following of Jesus when he was called. He was quick and open about naming Jesus as the Christ when he was asked, who do you say I am? Straight away, without thinking, he says, you are the Christ. And he is quick to stop Jesus when he has this sense of danger and Jesus setting his face to Jerusalem. He is the one saying, there is no way. We're going to Jerusalem because you will be killed there. Peter was always happy to step out and name Christ, follow Christ, stop Christ when he thought that was the best thing to do. He had his own story with Jesus. And of course, Peter also knew about sin and about being forgiven when you have done the darkest thing ever possible in your life. He was the one who in front of a whole bunch of people said, you know what, I don't even know him. I have no idea who he is. Fear made him say that. Fear makes us do things that we regret afterwards. Life makes us do things that we deeply, deeply regret afterwards. But Peter is also the disciple who was reinstalled in front of all of his friends as Jesus' disciple and as the one who would lead the church. He knew about betrayal. And he knew about being set free from guilt. And so he was sent to the world. Or rather, it was the world who was sent to him by God. Peter heard and went. Luckily enough for us, for the early church grew and spread all over the world. I wonder how that is for us. What do we see in our sheet? In what ways are we separating ourselves from the world? Are there any things that we do to stop the gospel being heard by others? Is there a way in which God is sending the world to us today? Do we limit God's grace to others? Are there any structures that we need to change so that we can actually meet the world and ask them, what is it that you came for? Do we as a church need to receive a new vision? Even as committed Christians, do we need to see God showing us something to take us into the future? I look around me and I see this big church. And as you know, I am trying to be here most Thursday mornings. And I walk around this empty church on a Thursday. And I pray a little bit and I look around a little bit and I see a massive place. But what I see most is a story, when I walk around, is a story of faithful people throughout the years. And they are people who were able and willing to take a risk. This is a church that sent out missionaries for years and years to places all over the world. This is a church who years ago, many years ago, knocked down two churches because they decided that makes no sense whatsoever. Let's just build one church. And that is why this church is here. These are a people who set up a mission in Lancaster Road to be a blessing to the people there. And they were. God bless the initiative. And when you read the story of Lancaster Road URC on their website, it's an amazing story of faithfulness of the people here. Lancaster Road is still a thriving church. That happened 130 years ago. And if I'm a few years out, I'm sure Stephen will correct me afterwards. 130 years ago, are we called to something new again? Are we called to perhaps do something risky as a church, as a people of God? Is God calling us still through the world to do something that may feel counterintuitive to us? Do we need to do something counterintuitive in order to carry God's message to the world? God's message of promise and of blessing, of healing and of being loved and forgiven. The world out there is waiting for it. The world out there is sent to us to ask us to tell them. God's law works different from our laws. But this we know. He promises us to love us, to be faithful, to be with us until the end of times. And he tells us that whatever seems impossible to us is possible with God.